and what to replace them with. Record numbers of migrants, including people driven out of their homes in Central America by the economic effects of the pandemic, gangs and natural disasters, surged to the border last summer, in part enticed by Joe Biden's promise of a less harsh approach to immigration than that of his predecessor. About 214,000 migrants were taken into custody in July of last year, the first time that many people had been apprehended in a single month in more than two decades. Joe Biden has taken a series of actions to reverse his predecessor's policies. He halted construction of the border wall, created a task force to reunite families separated at the border, and reversed Donald Trump's ban on considering domestic violence or gang violence as a basis for asylum. He also proposed sweeping legislation to overhaul the nation's immigration system, though it has stalled in Congress. But despite those actions, the infighting among the president's aides was on full display during the Oval Office meeting last March. Xavier Becerra, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, whose department runs shelters for migrant children, said the Department of Homeland Security needed to be aggressive in turning away older teenagers, which would have changed President Biden's policy of letting all unaccompanied migrant children into the country. Ms. Rice repeatedly said that Xavier Becerra should provide more shelters. Alejandro Mayorkas, the Secretary of Homeland Security, said the Department of Health and Human Services needed to move the children more quickly out of overcrowded Border Patrol stations. Ron Klain, the White House Chief of Staff, tried to play the mediator, to little effect. For months, aides clashed over an effort intended to speed up consideration of asylum cases at the border by allowing immigration officers to decide the claims rather than the overburdened judges. The goal was to streamline a court process that currently takes an average of 5 years to reach a decision for asylum seekers. Some of the former immigration advocates in the West Wing, including Ms. Rice's Deputy for Immigration, Esther Olivaria, worried that rushing through the new process would limit due process for migrants. Ms. Rice, Ron Klain, and others argued that processing claims faster, swiftly deporting migrants who failed to win asylum, was an important way to ease the burden on the system and deter illegal crossings. As the year went on, Joe Biden grew annoyed by the delays in putting the asylum changes into practice along the U.S. border with Mexico. In meetings on immigration with his top aides, he often asked what resources and funding the team of former advocates and immigration veterans needed for the policy. The administration did not release the final language for the new policy until last month. And because of staffing and funding issues, the plan will be rolled out slowly and not in time to offer significant help with the expected spike in migrants seeking asylum later on this spring. One of the most fraught debates inside the West Wing over the last year has been what to do about Donald Trump's Remain in Mexico policy, which forced migrants seeking asylum to wait south of the border until their cases were decided. Human rights advocates assailed the conditions in Mexico, where migrants often stayed in squalid camps, where they had no legal representation and were at risk of assault. As a candidate, Joe Biden had condemned the program. Once in office, he quickly terminated it. But it was one program that had been effective at keeping some migrants out of border detention facilities. During a meeting last summer convened to discuss options for dealing with the record numbers of migrants at the U.S. border, Ms. Sherwood Randall raised the possibility of restoring the program with some additional protections for migrants, according to two people familiar with the matter. That idea horrified immigration advocates inside the Biden administration, who viewed it not only as a breach of Joe Biden's campaign pledge, but also as a retreat from the promise of a more humane immigration system. Joe Biden, too, appeared uncomfortable with the idea, according to a person who was in the room for the meeting. The president told his team he would not forbid them to explore whether it was worth restoring the Remain in Mexico policy, but he made it clear that he did not want the idea leaking to the news media, and he did not want his name attached to it. The Supreme Court would later force the Biden administration to restore the Trump-era policy.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Okinawa, a Japanese island in the Western Pacific Ocean. The island was the scene of one of the fiercest battles of the Pacific War. It has marked the 50th anniversary of the end of U.S. occupation and its return to Japanese sovereignty after 27 years of U.S. rule. Okinawa returned to Japan on May 15, 1972. However, the island chain still hosts the majority of American military bases in Japan. It harbors about 70% of the U.S.'s military bases in Japan and more than half of its 47,000 troops. Many Japanese people, particularly Okinawans, are against the continued heavy American military presence and are protesting to draw attention to the issue.
Far from being reduced, as people in Okinawa demand, the U.S. military bases have even been strengthened instead. We hope the rally will help people in the prefecture and in other places realize the seriousness of the issue.
The presence of U.S. troops in Japan is not in any way intended to protect Japanese citizens, but a part of U.S. military strategy. Frequent incidents caused and crimes committed by U.S. troops in Japan only make Okinawa more dangerous.
Hundreds of protesters from across Japan have staged rallies in Okinawa demanding a reduction of U.S. military forces in the prefecture. In the city of Naha, more than 1,000 people from Tokyo, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, as well as Okinawa held an indoor gathering to call for peace and to oppose U.S. bases. Japanese locals on Okinawa have already been expressing serious opposition to the presence of U.S. forces on the island. A poll by the Asahi Shimbun newspaper and Okinawan media organizations found that 61% of local people wanted fewer U.S. bases on the island, while only 19% said they were happy with the status quo. Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, who promised to make a greater effort to reduce hosting U.S. military bases in the region, also acknowledged the issue as well as the economic inequalities that still make Okinawa one of the country's poorest areas.
50 years have passed since Okinawa's reversion to Japan, and the people of Okinawa still bear a heavy burden from the U.S. bases. The government takes this very seriously and will continue to do the utmost to reduce the burden from the bases.
A string of tropical islands located off far southwest Japan, Okinawa, has suffered massive devastation in World War II. Fierce battles between Japanese and American forces left as many as one-third of its people dead. Then around 30 years of U.S. rule followed. And Japan has not forgotten those days. Despite their opposition to U.S. troop presence, Okinawans are more concerned about the threat of a military confrontation involving China. Okinawa is closer to Taiwan than the capital, Tokyo. This could turn it into a target to be the front line in case of a conflict between the US and China. Beijing considers Taiwan as its territory and views US military provocations as a sign of support for those inside Taiwan who seek independence. American warships periodically carry out voyages through the strategic Taiwan Strait, drawing angry responses from China. The US is also the island's key backer and main arms supplier. Tensions in Okinawa are likely to rise further given that lawmakers in the ruling Liberal Democratic Party have said that they want a commitment to more defense spending, including missiles that can hit targets on foreign soil. Missiles that could be deployed on Okinawa.
The United States uses its force and uses its bullying tactics to impose its will on other countries. So I don't know that in the minds of the Japanese government that they are really able to operate as totally sovereign, independent entities when it comes to going against the interests of the United States.
Considering the latest developments, Okinawa could soon find itself in the middle of another conflict, one that is reminiscent of a dark point in its history. And this time again, Washington plays a role in it. On May 15, 1948, the Zionist regime forced some 750,000 Palestinians to leave their homes and villages and expelled them into refugee camps that still exist in the occupied West Bank, Gaza, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. Armed Zionist forces massacred entire villages of men, women, and even children. That pushed rightful owners of Palestine to leave their homes and lands as they feared losing their lives. Consequently, that provided the ground for Zionists to establish the Israeli regime. The Palestinians were to suffer further when the West Bank and Gaza fell to the Israelis during the 1967 war, also known as the Six-Day War. Millions of Palestinians, including those displaced since 1948, found themselves under military occupation as well as further Israeli expansionism in their lands. Palestinians want the West Bank as part of a future independent Palestinian state, with East Al-Quds as its capital. But Israel's settlement expansion and annexation plans have dealt a serious blow to any prospects of peace. The Gaza Strip has also been under an inhumane Israeli land, air, and sea siege since 2007, and witnessed three wars since 2008. More than 600,000 Israelis currently live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the West Bank and East Al-Quds. That's while all Israeli settlement activities are illegal under international law. Every year, Palestinians reaffirm their right to return to their homes and villages in historic Palestine on Nakba Day. They hold annual rallies to commemorate decades of ethnic cleansing of their homeland by the Zionist regime to establish what's known today as Israel. This year, thousands of Palestinians and their supporters across the globe have taken to the streets to hold mass rallies in commemoration of the 74th anniversary of Nakba, or Catastrophe Day, and to condemn the recent killing of a veteran Palestinian journalist by Israeli forces. Shirin Abu Aghaleh was fatally shot by Israeli troops as she was covering an army raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the northern part of the occupied West Bank. Targeting the media organizations and journalists isn't an accident. This is systematic targeting of media to create a cloak of secrecy around Israeli crimes.
This is something that is extremely important because it is the part of the historical memory of a culture and people have been subjugated by an illegal occupation of an apartheid regime.
In an expression of solidarity with the people of Palestine, the Iranian Foreign Ministry stated that addressing the issue of Palestine should be the first and foremost issue for the Muslim world, saying any attempt by global Zionism to drive the issue into oblivion would be doomed to failure. The Iranian ministry also stated that the anniversary of Nakba puts on display the failure of international institutions and organizations to resolve one of the longest-running humanitarian and political crises in the world. Israel has managed to get away with its crimes for decades as it enjoys Washington's unwavering support. The U.S. provides the regime with billions of dollars in lethal aid every year. It also invariably uses its veto power at the United Nations to block the world body's anti-Israeli resolutions.
Well, I think that the complicity of basically the Western political class in its entirety and the media in the West is inseparable from the question of Israeli impunity. Israel knows full well that it can do whatever it wants, that it can kill journalists, that it can kill Palestinian children, that it can continue with administrative detention and systematic torture of Palestinian prisoners, and that they'll get away with it because they will never be sanctioned by any of the so-called Western democracies.
This has quietly encouraged the Tel Aviv regime to continue violating the rights of Palestinians and to displace them and to steal their land. But how long will the regime of Tel Aviv be able to extend its illegal existence through carnage and plunder? Former Israeli Premier Ehud Barak has expressed concern about Israel's survival, saying the entity will cease to exist before the 80th anniversary of its 1948 establishment. The ultra-conservative former premier's comments echo prevailing fears in the occupied territories. A recent survey of young Israeli adults found that nearly half of the population in the occupied Palestinian territories is not optimistic about Israel's future, with more than one-third of people thinking about migrating for jobs and better life. Many analysts have pointed to the theory of collapse from within regarding the future of Israel, citing three factors of economic crisis, poor security situation and social divisions for the imminent decline and fall of the regime.
On Wednesday, two journalists covering an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin for Qatari broadcaster Al Jazeera came under attack. Ali Al-Samoudi was shot in the back but survived. His colleague, Shirin Abu Akla, however, wasn't as lucky. The reporter was shot in the head and was pronounced dead after being rushed to the hospital. The attack came despite them both wearing vests with the word press emblazoned on them.
It wants the image of absolute lawlessness and operating with impunity. What could be more criminal than the targeted assassination? And just to say how strongly the whole world feels and the outrage at the assassination of Shirin Abu Akleh.
Also, according to eyewitnesses, the attack was unprovoked as there was no confrontation between Palestinians and the regime's forces at the time of the assault on the journalists.
The occupation is murderous and criminal. They shot us for no reason. We, a group of journalists, were there wearing our full press uniform in addition to the helmets with the word press written in large letters, as big as the whole world. We were obvious. We made sure to walk right in front of the army patrols so that they can see us, and they saw us after we went to a road where there were no armed people, no civilians, and there were no shooting and no incidents there. We were shocked by the shooting. I was lucky and I turned my back when the first bullet was shot and injured my back. They wanted to kill me. I was injured in my back and the second bullet shot my colleague Shirin and caused her death.
But the regime didn't spare Abu Akla, even at her funeral. Israeli troops attacked mourners carrying the slain journalist's casket outside the hospital, causing the coffin to almost fall to the ground. She was later laid to rest in a cemetery in occupied East Al-Quds. The journalist's killing and the subsequent attack during her funeral were met with international condemnation, with Israel's closest ally, the United States, calling it, quote, deeply concerning. The United Nations human rights experts have called the incident a serious attack on the freedom of media and expression and called for a transparent investigation. The case of the journalist set to be brought to the International Criminal Court, a tribunal that has in the past attempted to probe Israel's rights violations and war crimes against Palestinians, but failed to do so due to political pressure and sanctions from the United States. Israel's aggression against countries like Syria and Lebanon has also been protested in the international arena. But so far, the reactions from the international community have been limited to verbal support. That begs the question, will Tel Aviv face any accountability for its crimes?
Within international courts, because who controls international courts? And who controls the International Criminal Court while they're not even a signer to it? That's U.S. imperialism. So I don't think Israel will be brought to any kind of justice or accountability through this. But I think it's up to the people of the world. It's up to all honest reporters, journalists, and news services to make sure that this does not go unmarked.
Some observers also ascribe the intensified Israeli pressure on Palestinians to some Arab states' moves to normalize ties with the regime. The Arab states had claimed that their decisions would help the Palestinian cause, an excuse that has repeatedly proven to be nothing more than mere window dressing over the past 2 years. Many Palestinians believe that in the absence of any international accountability, resistance remains their only way forward.
A state of shock in America, especially among members of the Native American community, following the identification of over 500 student deaths at U.S. boarding schools. The deaths of Native American children were confirmed as part of the first stage of a federal study of boarding schools that operated for over a century. They were supposed to assimilate the indigenous children into white society between 1819 and 1969. The number of deaths could be only the tip of the iceberg, as the U.S. Interior Department warns that with further investigation, the number of known student deaths could climb to the thousands or even tens of thousands. The initial findings of the comprehensive study have turned a spotlight on the dark history of more than 400 Native American boarding schools notorious for brutal conditions. Hundreds of thousands of indigenous children were forced by the U.S. federal government to attend the institutions. The children were separated from their families by force, forbidden from speaking their languages, and often abused. A large number of them never returned home. The painful legacy of the notorious system operated by the government and churches has been felt deeply across Indian country and through generations. The high-profile federal review was ordered by U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland last year after the discovery of unmarked graves at the site of former residential schools in neighboring Canada.
So it's the same history, really. There's really, the thing is, the United States had such a huge population of Native people, such a wealth of anthropology. If you could imagine what anthropologists today would give to be able to hurriedly record all those languages and take pictures, but they're gone. You can't even record the dead civilizations. And if they were allowed to live, the earth would be so much wealthier. It's really just a terrible, terrible tragedy. That is the real genocide. That's genocide number one.
The U.S. Interior Department's report was released on Wednesday. It highlighted instances of beating, withholding of food and solitary confinement, and other forms of abuse at U.S. boarding schools. U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, whose grandparents attended such schools, seems to be very serious about the investigation. She has ordered her agency to fully investigate what remains of the evidence of the horrific abuses.
Now we are uniquely positioned to assist in the effort to recover the dark history of these institutions that have haunted our families for too long.
She says the consequences of federal Indian boarding school policies, including the trauma caused by the family separation and cultural eradication inflicted on generations of children as young as 4 years old, are heartbreaking and undeniable. Brian Newland, the Assistant Secretary of the Interior for Indian Affairs, believes further investigation is needed to better understand the lasting effects of the boarding school system on American Indians. Newland said there is not a single American Indian, Alaskan Native, or Native Hawaiian in the country whose life has not been impacted by the notorious boarding school system. Meanwhile, the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition warned that efforts to find the remains of the indigenous children must continue until the United States fully accounts for the genocide committed against Native American children. The latest findings are shedding light on the plight of Native Americans in the United States. They are still suffering from many problems, including racial discrimination. Pressure is mounting on the U.S. establishment to come to terms with and learn lessons from its dark past.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic.
I wish to raise some concluding points. Dear brothers, dear sisters, the opportunity of having a responsibility is very fleeting, and it will soon come to an end. Therefore, you must appreciate the value of this opportunity. You must use every hour of it. The second word of advice is that you should not work for the purpose of a show. You should not think of working for the sake of being seen by the people who have elected you or the people who watch you on television. This will spoil the blessedness of your work. If you think of doing something to make the people like you and you do not think of the significance of the task and of divine satisfaction, the blessedness of your work will be gone, and on many occasions you will not achieve any result either. The third issue is the conflict of interest. I see that the term conflict of interest is frequently used in the Majlis, in the Parliament. The conflict of interest does not only exist in the economy. These conflicts exist in other areas as well. if we have some interest in the people's attention to us, and if another interest is the public interest of the country, here too there is a conflict of interests. Which one do you prioritize? If we prioritize our reputation and the people's attention to us over the interests of the country, this is an example of conflict of interest. We must take God into account. This is another issue.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The Majlis, the parliament, and the administration have specific duties on the basis of the law. In another meeting, I mentioned that these lines must be observed. Things must develop in a way that the administration has its own responsibilities for which it must be answerable. The Majlis should be answerable too, so that one can judge its performance. If things get mixed up, it will become difficult to judge. Dear God, by the blessedness of Muhammad and his household, make our intentions pure. Make what we said, what we did, and what we will say and do serve you and your cause. Dear God, make our hearts brim over with the purity of our actions on your path. Dear God, by the blessedness of Muhammad and his household, associate our magnanimous Imam who opened this path to the nation and who brought us to this arena and this path, with your prophets and saints, make his immaculate soul satisfied with us. Make the pure souls of our dear martyrs satisfied with us. Bestow your reward, patience, blessings, and mercy on their families. Greetings be upon you and God's mercy and blessings.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
In mid-May 2016, Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders told his supporters in Kentucky that the U.S. was heading toward becoming an oligarchy state.
But what we are addressing right now is a real threat of oligarchy in America. And as you all know, what oligarchy is about is a handful of wealthy families controlling the economic and political life of this nation. And if anybody here thinks that we are not moving in that direction, where a handful of billionaires and Wall Street and multinational corporations controlling the economic and political life of this nation. If you don't think that that is what is happening now, you are not paying attention.
4 years later, Sanders endorsed Joe Biden as the Democratic nominee for president, a man who had already been in the U.S. political arena for almost half a century, an oligarch per excellence.
This election is the most important in the modern history of this country. In response to the unprecedented crises we face, we need an unprecedented response, a movement like never before, of people who are prepared to stand up and fight for democracy and decency and against greed, oligarchy, and bigotry. And we need Joe Biden as our next president.
Sanders' seemingly surprise move was a major step toward bringing unity to his party's effort to unseat Trump, who was regarded even among some Republicans as the outsider. The fact is, while the United States presents itself as the beacon of democracy, it is hardly more than an oligarchy. A study carried out in 2014 by two political scientists, Martin Gillens and Benjamin Page, found that economic elites and organized groups representing business interests have substantial independent impacts on U.S. government policy, while average citizens have little or no independent influence. To have political influence here means Congress responds to you by passing the laws and policies you like. Low influence means you're ignored. Congress passes laws that have no relationship to what you want. According to the research, not only do the wealthy have the most influence in the U.S., ordinary voters have basically none.
Whether a particular form of governance or democracy is good or bad has got to be decided on the sole criteria of the benefit it has provided for the common man. Policy coming out of Washington today has little to do with democracy, but is rather a raw political attempt to assert the continued domination of the ruling financial oligarchy centered in the major banks of London and New York and backed up by the military alliance of the United States.
Meanwhile, America's oligarchic wealth has reached levels sometimes exceeding those of Russia and China. During the COVID-19 pandemic, America's 745 billionaires increased their holdings by 70%, adding $2.1 trillion to their wealth in just over a year. No doubt a portion of this wealth goes into politics. The Koch brothers said they invested about $250 million in the 2016 election for Republicans, while Michael Bloomberg spent about $23 million on Democrats in the same year.
This is not a partisan issue. This is an issue of mission. This is an issue of morality. This is an issue of what kind of nation we want to live in. Do we want to live in a nation where people have the right to elect their representatives and their leaders? Or do we want to live in an oligarchy or a plutocracy where only a handful of people call the shots? We must lead on this issue.
As early as 2012, more than 40% of all money spent in federal elections came from the wealthiest of the wealthiest, not the top 1% or even the top 10th of the 1%, but from the top 1% of the 1%. More and more Americans now realize that their democracy has morphed into an oligarchy. The combined wealth of America's top 400 billionaires came to $2.7 trillion in 2017, which is more than the entire GDP of Italy, $1.8 trillion, or France, $2.5 trillion. The U.S. government's ability to really serve its citizens has been kneecapped for the private interests of a relative few.
In a July 2017 poll by the Association Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research, 75% of Americans believed people like them had too little influence in Washington, and 82% believed that the rich had too much power over the government.
I still say they are illegally running something in the United States of America. How dare they call this a democracy when it's not government for the people, by the people, but by an oligarchy, government controlled by the few. That's what the United States is.
Even the Trump administration, which claimed to be a voice of the people, championing their interests against a Washington elite, was the culmination of oligarchic rule, an administration totally at the service of arms companies, among others.
With every war, the ruling military, industrialist, oligarchs enjoyed phenomenal growth of their wealth and influence. While young Americans, mostly underprivileged and poor, would sacrifice their lives in the sinister cycle of killing and getting killed. All in the name of the universal values of freedom, democracy, and human rights.
In 2020, the Center for International Policy, CIP, released a report revealing that more than $1 billion had been donated to top 50 U.S. think tanks by U.S. defense contractors between 2014 and 2019. These think tanks play into the hands of the U.S. Defense Department's narrative with their reports and media releases. The political clout of billionaires has increased since the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizen United decision, which determined that election spending regulations restrict the right of corporations to free speech. As for Biden, his promise to build back better has turned out to be an empty promise, and things are pretty much the same as before. His American Rescue Bill provides just enough relief to enable people to go back to living lives as economically stressed as they were before the pandemic. Even before the pandemic, 40% of Americans could not afford a $400 unexpected expenditure. A system that consistently makes it easier for the rich to get richer and harder for the poor to even make it at all is not called democracy. When the American citizens cannot seriously consider a 3% wealth tax on billionaires, yet cannot raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, they cannot call their ruling system democracy. When the three richest people in the US, Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, and Warren Buffett, own more than the bottom half of the country combined, doesn't oligarchy describe the system more accurately? All in all, the biggest divide in America today runs between oligarchy and democracy. When oligarchs fill the coffers of political candidates, they can be confident there will be no meaningful action against them and in favor of ordinary people. The U.S. political system has been widely but wrongly described as the one of the people, by the people and for the people. In reality, it is run by a group of oligarchs that make up the ruling class of American society. It is not owned or ruled by the people. It's just shouldered by the people.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. We'll be right back.
in the limelight.
Virus has laid bare America's fragmented healthcare system and corrosive racial and socioeconomic inequality. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jessica Glenza, journalist. This article is published under the heading U.S. COVID deaths hit 1 million, a death toll higher than any other country. Stay tuned for more. More than 1 million people have died in the COVID-19 pandemic in the U.S., according to Johns Hopkins, far and away the most deaths of any country. While the sheer number of deaths from the coronavirus sets the U.S. apart, the country's large population of 332.5 million people does not explain the staggering mortality rate, which is among the highest in the world. For every 100,000 residents, 291 people have died from COVID-19, according to the Johns Hopkins University Coronavirus Resource Center. Among the 20 worst affected nations, only two other countries, including Brazil and Poland, have higher mortality rates per 100,000 people. Deaths directly attributable to COVID-19 are only one measure of the pandemic's toll. Deaths from drug overdoses hit a record high in 2021, killing at least 100,000 Americans. Chronic conditions such as heart disease, hypertension, and dementia have contributed to the number of excess deaths, a number which includes other ailments exacerbated by the pandemic, as well as those deaths caused directly by COVID-19. This number crossed the 1 million threshold in mid-February. The extraordinary toll has set the U.S. apart among wealthy peer nations, exposing inequality, a unique and fragmented health system, and polarized politics, all of which likely made the crisis worse, researchers said. In terms of understanding why we had such a bad experience from the pandemic, we have to think about the systematic issues that already were in place when the pandemic arrived, said Stephen Wolf, a social epidemiologist and population health researcher at Virginia Commonwealth University, adding, and on top of that, mishandling of the pandemic by the U.S. government and by the public, frankly. The pandemic shone a light on longstanding racial and ethnic health disparities as Black, Latino, and Native American people were infected, hospitalized, and died of COVID-19 at rates that were, at times, double those of white Americans. The drivers of those outcomes, the disproportionate likelihood for people of color to lack the same quality housing, employment, and healthcare access as white Americans, are well known and documented. Such disparities are the intended or unintended consequences of policy decisions, a recent commentary in the Journal of the American Medical Association said. The U.S. has nonetheless had difficulty correcting course. Vaccines were at first slow to reach minority, low-income, and rural areas. One recent study has shown how at least one advanced COVID-19 therapy, monoclonal antibodies, were the least likely to reach the highest-risk patients for whom they were recommended. It just exacerbated the struggles we currently have and pulled back the curtain on all the issues we've been dealing with for so many years, said Terrence Shirley, CEO of the Community Health Center Association of Mississippi. community health centers help treat indigent and marginalized Americans who cannot pay for health care. The all-consuming nature of the pandemic has also allowed preventable and treatable infectious diseases to flourish. Thousands of young children, particularly in low-income households, have fallen behind on routine vaccinations. Rates of sexually transmitted diseases have reached the highest numbers in American history, as overwhelmed and underfunded local health agencies reallocated resources to COVID-19. Meanwhile, the mental health of adolescents in particular has suffered as millions were cut off from the mental health services provided by schools. Pediatricians, children's hospitals, and psychiatrists declared a mental health crisis among the nation's youth, and a recent CDC study has shown how emergency room visits for eating disorders has increased dramatically among adolescents, girls. Millions of children were also thrust into food insecurity as the numbers of children receiving school meals plummeted. Missed academic time appears to have caused the educational and achievement gap to widen. The U.S. has been experiencing worse health outcomes for some years now. Life expectancy in the U.S. is the lowest of any high-income country, said Wolf, adding, there is a set of reasons for it, but all of those rolled right into the pandemic. However, America's reliance on an expensive private and exclusionary healthcare system is not solely to blame. Although policies that exclude 28 million uninsured individuals from healthcare have likely made things worse, they're only one example of how fragmented policy has worsened Americans' health. Concepts fundamental to U.S. governance also proved problematic in the pandemic. In just one example, the U.S. Constitution makes public health the responsibility of individual states, creating a patchwork of different pandemic responses. Culture and environment also appear played a role. Americans are more likely than citizens of other countries to engage in what public health researchers consider risky behavior, such as gun ownership, smoking, consuming more calories, and exercising less. Polarized politics make it more difficult to implement guardrails on these behaviors. Floundering responses by federal, state, and local governments compounded existing issues and eventually allowed pandemic-related public health guidance to become political and cultural footballs. Less than two-thirds of Republicans have received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, compared with 91% of Democrats, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation's January 2022 vaccine tracking poll. The only thing both parties appear to agree on, according to the same poll, is how the pandemic has exhausted them. That has led to another riddle. As more and more pandemic prevention measures are dropped, Americans will be faced with how to live with a disease that can be chronic and disabling, even if it isn't as deadly. Death is not the only serious outcome from COVID, said David Potrino, the director of Rehabilitation Innovation for Mount Sinai Health System. Potrino has seen thousands of cases of so-called long COVID, where many varied and at times severe symptoms persist for months. A recent analysis by the Center for American Progress found the syndrome resulted in an estimated 1.2 million more disabled people in 2021. Shirley said, "We are addressing the acute illness and not resolving the issues that could prevent the illness in the first place."
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Petrovsky, a district of Donetsk. The front line is only a few kilometers away. The Ukrainian army has been shelling the district since 2014, and since the war with Russia began, the shelling has intensified. A school. Two shells landed yesterday in the playground.
Yesterday in the morning, approximately from 8 until 9, two missiles hit here, from either Novomikhailovka or Krasnogorovka. You could hear some whistling and two explosions. One hit the big tree over there, another hit over here. And 18 windows in the school were damaged.
The janitor cleans up the glass from the shattered windows to the sound of outgoing artillery fired by the Donbass separatists.
The janitor at that school told us that another school had been hit just a few hours ago in Petrovsky, so we're going there now to see what damage has been done.
A branch blown off and shattered glass. It is fortunate the children here are currently learning from home.
I found some shrapnel, deadly pieces of shrapnel that will kill or injure anybody nearby. And it's strange here seeing people still walking about and looking out their windows. At any time, one of these missiles could hit them.
Another recent strike on an apartment building. Two people were confirmed killed. 20 meters away, children play. Since 2014, over 100 children have been killed by Ukrainian shelling, and over 14,000 people in total. We hear of more shelling today on some houses.
No, my house was hit on 3rd of May. Not today. Not directly my house, but my fence was damaged by shrapnel. Today house number 30 was hit. Let's go.
A few houses along, another fence destroyed.
What happened? The shooting started and we couldn't understand where it was from. Then we heard a rustling sound. It was above our heads. It hit once, twice, the third, then the fourth hit here. I saw the smoke and thought there was a fire.
While thousands of people have left Petrovsky, many, like Yulia, prefer to stay. They have nowhere else to go and prefer living under shelling than becoming refugees.
What can I say? It happens often. There are many places hit, not only here, but near the roundabout, the big supermarkets, and people die every day. When will it end?
So, why do you not leave here?
Where should we go? It's our earth, our ground, our houses are here. Why should we go anywhere? We didn't go to shoot at anyone. We have always been here. For what reason they shoot at us?
It's difficult to explain just how strange it is here in Petrovsky district. The people who are still here are leaving their lives in the hands of God or chance. Every day there are dozens of missile strikes here. While it's quiet at the moment, there's usually the constant rumble of incoming and outgoing artillery.
While the vast majority of shelling in this war is being done by Russia, who currently have air and artillery superiority, the uncomfortable truth is that Ukraine is also killing civilians. Indeed, as it sees it, its own civilians. And they have been doing so for the last 8 years. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
Donetsk.
The Hungarian government, led by Viktor Orban, is attracting scathing criticism from other EU nations. Citing an enormous economic impact, Orban is refusing to agree on an EU-wide ban on oil being imported from Russia. The impasse was discussed at length by EU foreign affairs ministers on Monday. They have agreed to send €500 million to Europe.